This is a Radio.com original.
You know, I talked to a lot of his friends, and they just said life with him was just so interesting. I remember James Coburn, yeah, a great actor, just basically saying, you know, guys like McLean made life interesting. And he said, no, I'm going to miss him. You know, McLean was just one of those guys that just, if something wasn't happening, he made it happen.
Hey, everybody, greetings and exclamations. It's time for another Talking About Cars podcast. I'm Randy Cardoon. Alone this time, Hot Rod Bob Beck has something really important to be doing, and he's getting it done right now. So that's good. It's been a while since I've done this thing alone. Let's see if I still remember how to do it. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the late Steve McQueen. You know the actor, the late Steve McQueen. He was in so many great movies. Bullet, The Great Escape. He was in The Blob. Did you know that? The great Steve McQueen? He was in The Blob. He was also in Towering Inferno. That was later in his career. But he had one thing going that everybody who's a car person knows about. He was a car guy. He was also a motorcycle guy. And he loved it. And that's what we're bringing you in this edition of the Talking About Cars podcast. We're talking a little bit about Steve McQueen, the late Steve McQueen, who passed away due to cancer at the age of 50. Boy, that's young. That is so young. Steve McQueen said a lot of things, did a lot of things, and he loved cars, and he loved fast motorcycles and fast cars. There's a guy who has written a book, and it's an interesting book, and it's basically in the words of Steve McQueen as he spoke them. And that'll be kind of fun to talk a little bit about as we talk with the guy who wrote the book, Marshall Terrell, and he's going to be joining us as soon as I snap my fingers, because that's kind of what we do. And since Bob isn't here to do the big introduction, I'll just do it myself. But again, we're going to talk a little bit about Steve McQueen and talk a little bit about some of the things that made him a car guy and kind of get behind his head 40 years after his passing. That's right, 40 years ago he passed away. And quite a career he left, and again, quite a legacy when it comes to cars. So, without further ado, let's bring in Marshall Terrell. And there he is, ladies and gentlemen. Marshall Terrell joining us here on the Talking About Cars podcast. Marshall from his palatial mansion somewhere in the mountain time zone, at least he is this time of the way. Marshall, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm in beautiful Tempe, Arizona, where it's 94 degrees today.
Wow.
Yep.
Very good for you and us. Tell us a little bit about this book. I mean, you've done a lot of books for kind of personality profiles for a lot of celebrities. What was it about in this concept regarding Steve McQueen? First off, explain kind of what the book is all about.
Well, it's called Steve McQueen in His Own Words, and the concept is to have a photo book, but the real idea was the fact that I kept seeing all these McQueen books come out year after year, and I've written more than anybody, so I just want to say that I'm in that class, and I'm the biggest offender, but I've seen McQueen books come out year after year, and then I started thinking, you know what, the poor guy has really, he never got to speak out, because he was a closed-in introvert, but he never really got to say what he wanted to say about his life. He did want to do a book at the end of his life. Then he got cancer, and he was going to do it with Charles Champlin, great writer from the Los Angeles Times. And I just started thinking, you know, all these guys have written these books about Steve McQueen, but he's never really had a chance to say what it is that he wanted to say about his life. And so I thought, you know, there's a unique way to do this, because I have done so much research over the years, and I collect the research. I've collected it now for over 30 years, and I continue to collect it, and I continue to meet people that knew him. So I thought, well, let's do a cool photo book that has his quotes that matches what he said about his life chronologically all the way up to the end of his life. So I have quotes from him dating from his birth all the way right up to his death. I've got a 60-minute audio tape of McQueen 3 weeks before he died, talking about his life talking about his wishes, talking about his hopes and his dreams. And so then I started formulating this idea, but I thought, oh, this would be cool and this would be fun and this will be fast. It didn't turn out to be the latter. I started this in 2014.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's obvious you did the work because there's, what is it, 500 quotes? 500, or 350, I don't remember, 500?
547 quotes.
Wow. And that's a lot of quotes, I'm sorry.
I founded that, did McQueen really talk that much? And the answer is yes. In the early part of his career, he did. He was very fond, well, he wanted to build his career, but he was very fond of Luella Parsons, who had a syndicated column that appeared six times a week. And so he was, during his rise to fame, he was constantly talking to her and constantly filling her a little, giving her little tidbits here and there. And in these little tidbits, he'd talk about fame. He'd talk about, you know, anything that kind of struck his fancy. And of course, he talked to a lot of motorcycle and car racing magazines. But then by the time Bullitt reached around, he really stopped talking to the press because he really no longer needed them. He had established himself. So the interesting thing about McQueen's life is, you know, the second part of his life from that period from 1970 to 1980, there's a lot less photos of him. There's a lot less quotes. There's a lot less interviews. But I think I did a good job of filling in that gap.
Well, I think at the beginning, certainly we caught up to some of the quotes in there. And I got to tell you, if you like picture books, this is a great picture book. I mean, you have some really great candid shots. You have some really great shots of him with cars, including some of the cars he had when he first started getting into vehicles and that kind of thing, and including his beloved XK XX. Was that what? No. Wait a minute. Where is it? Hold yeah. on. Was it the XK XX? Yes. It was in the 50s. It was racing green. And apparently that car he bought, sold, bought it back, and basically hung on to it until he died in around 1980 or so, right?
Right. And then that car is, I think it's today in the Peter Museum and worth millions. And that car in particular really kind of showed his exquisite taste. But it reminds me of one of the quotes in the book, which I think is one of the most classic quotes. And that is he had talked about the actor Tony Curtis when, you know, he said, when I started making it, I read this article on Tony Curtis, and he talked about how he became so successful. And he'd walk out to his driveway, and there'd be 10 cars lined up, and he looked at them, and he didn't know which car to take that day. And McQueen basically said, and I've got a picture to illustrate this, and son of a gun, if it didn't happen to me.
Yeah, the picture is him and a couple of Ferraris, which look pretty identical, except for the color.
Right, but it would be wonderful to be in that spot to wonder which beautiful $100,000 car you're going to drive today.
You know, I can't say I know what that's like. You?
No. I cannot.
Nah, my cars are a little cheaper than that, but still a lot of fun. Let's talk about some of these. And I thought just some of it, it's interesting how he, in a way, was a simple guy, even though he had a tough upbringing. He always had vehicles going as part of his life. He basically talked about how automobiles and car and motorcycles were really a big key in his life.
Right. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was very poor growing up, and motorcycles and cars symbolized to him what he didn't have. And they were, I guess, a yardstick, I guess, in a way to measure your success. So that was important to him. But there was also, of course, if you're a car guy, there's the love of machinery. And he had that too. And I think that was instinctual.
I think some of the stories you talk about, you have a picture of him with an MG early in his life, and apparently this is something he won during a poker game or something like that. And unfortunately, that car met a semi-tragic demise.
Well, and the funny thing is that the demise was that he ran over, a manhole. I guess, you know, in New York City, and I visited New York City in 1989. And I visited a cop buddy, and he drove me around the streets. and it was in my car, and we got 3 flat tires that night for the same thing. So I kind of understood exactly what happened to him. Of course, he broke his car in half. I don't know how that happened. He had 3 flat tires, but I could see where that happened.
Well, according to this, he drove it into an excavation hole in Manhattan. That would pretty much do it for me. Those MGs, as cool as they weren't exactly very sturdily built, right?
Correct. Yes. So, yeah, I think he just left it there. So, maybe it got buried over by the city.
Yeah, maybe it's still in that hole somewhere in Manhattan. Who knows? Anytime they ever peel up that old blacktop or something like that, they may find it sitting there sometime. He talks a little bit about, page 89, I seem to remember he was talking about his world is very small. All I really know are motorcycles and cars. I guess I live in a world of men. You know, he was a cool guy. I mean, back in the day, he was considered the epitome of cool, I guess.
And even today, I mean, a lot of people kind of use him as a yardstick for cool. They use him as a yardstick or as the ultimate male. I love that quote because I think the reporter at the time kind of made him think about his life at that time, which was basically he worked, he slept, he raced. And everything that he read were basically motorcycle and car magazines, and that was kind of it. So for him to talk about living in the world of men was absolutely true.
Yeah, he was very much into vehicles. He was very much into motorcycles. Almost, and I get the feeling that it was more into motorcycles than it was into vehicles. Is that kind of what you got out of it?
Yes, and he alternated because, you know, shortly after Wanted Dead or Alive, he did buy a very, I don't know the make of the model, but it was a Lotus. So he did start car racing afterwards. He was actually car racing in New York City as a struggling actor. And I've seen pictures, and it looked like he was racing that MG. So he alternated between both. I think the more consistent one throughout his life was motorcycles. And it was easier, I guess, you know, if he just wanted to go and he wanted to take off. Whereas car racing required a little bit more effort, a little bit more money. And motorcycle was something he could do with his buddies if they just wanted to go out and, you know, take a trip and do a camping thing.
You know, it's interesting also how he kind of, he grew up kind of in a bad situation, really. He was in one of those boys' homes out in Chino, California, of all places. And he grew up there. He went away, joined the Marines, apparently got himself a job. He was always, I guess, pretty handy with engines because he got himself a job trying to maintain tanks.
Yes, he maintained tanks in the Marines and did actually quite well. You know, he talked about how, you know, he wasn't very good, but I think he did that to enhance his rebel image. But he looked at his records, and I had a Marine Corps expert with us. He said, you know, he advanced pretty quickly during non-wartime. And McQueen had always talked about, you know, he would never get promoted if he advanced pretty quickly, and I think it was because he was pretty handy. He said he tried to scoop up an engine in the Marine Corps with a tank, and he found out that you couldn't.
Can't scoop up a tank engine. Whether you're in the Marine Corps, the Army, or anything, you can't do it, which is kind of too bad because that would have been interesting. I think nowadays they wouldn't have minded if you were able to soup up an engine for a tank. But those things are pretty big.
Yes, but the great thing about the Marines was, like the Boys Republic that you mentioned earlier, it gave him a form of discipline. So the Boys Republic, it disciplined him for life, and the Marines got him to the next phase, which was acting.
And, of course, acting, as he got better and better, and he made more and more money, he was able to buy nicer and nicer cars. We talked a little bit about the Ferrari situation when he had the 2 cars he was looking at going, decision. Were those basically his Ferraris, or did they bring him over and say, you can buy one or the other, or did you know that at all?
I seem to recall that there was definitely one, but there were scenarios like that where they would, where car dealers and motorcycle manufacturers would make deals with him, where he would pose with the car and he would get their car, their motorcycle for an extended period of time, or do we just get it all together? So you do have an interesting point there.
I don't know. Go ahead.
I seem to think that his garage maintained maybe 6 cars at a time, and that's what he was rotating.
We talked about the Jaguar. The Jaguar Racing Green XKSS, not XX, XKSS. And we talked about how he bought it back and forth and all that. And there was a notation in there that said that apparently he bought it back. I guess he sold it to an LA TV personality. Do we know who that LA TV personality was? Do you have the initials?
I'm saying if I could remember, I'd give it to you. But I'm getting to a certain age now where I'm quickly approaching 60, and the memory just isn't what it used to be.
Okay, I'll take that as an answer. Sure. Okay, we'll have to investigate that on our own, I think, somewhere down the line. I've got a couple of thoughts myself, because it sounds like a host of a show, or maybe a newscaster or something like that. But one of his quotes, another quote, when he talks about motorcycles and how much fun it is for him, it was really an outlet for him. You know, a lot of people will go work out. A lot of people will do other things, play golf, do different things. But when it came to motorcycles, that was really the release point, it sounded, at least from the way it was presented, that the late Steve McQueen, how he looked at motorcycle riding.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what he said. He said, motorcycle racing is a release for me. You know, he actually did do workout, 2-hour workout every morning. And then the motorcycles were really kind of for the weekend. But one of the quotes was, it drains me. It gets all the junk out of my system. And it was good that he recognized that, you know. A lot of people don't know what would be good therapy for them. And, you know, when he became famous, now keep in mind, this is a guy that goes from this painful childhood, and all of a sudden everything's flip-flopped, and it's what he called Candyland. He gets everything that he wants. And so he doesn't trust anybody to begin with. And now he's in Hollywood where everything's given to him, and he doesn't trust anyone. So what do you do? You find that release, and racing was that release for him.
That's actually pretty smart, though, if you know Hollywood. So it turned out to be probably wise thinking on his part.
And he also talked about he did not want to be one of those actors that waited by the phone or for a call, and he wanted to develop another part of his life, and racing gave that to him. It gave him his identity. And again, another thing that I think is just beautiful, and it's smart.
What was it that you learned about Steve McQueen from doing this book that maybe surprised you or that you didn't know before?
Well, I certainly think that, and I've always thought he was smart, but this kind of, as you read the quotes, there's a certain street knowledge that he brought, you know, to certain street wisdom that he brought to life. I mean, you read these things and you can't help but look at him and go, yeah, he's absolutely right. But he was a lot more insightful than I thought he was. A lot of people thought, oh, he's just a school guy riding a motorcycle. But the real answer is, especially when it came to Hollywood, the first one is, there's nothing in the world that I don't want to know. And that appeals to the journalist in me. And what he was referring to was Hollywood. And that he wanted to know everything on the other side of the camera. He wanted to know about the distribution end. He wanted to know everything because he knew that it was going to benefit him. So I love that quote. And then the second quote was, a reporter asked him, what has success done for you? And this appeals to the cynic in me. And he answered, well, I seem to have a lot more friends.
Yeah, I can imagine so. Well, I found it interesting, though, when you had the look at his early part of his career, and he was talking about some of the early movies he did. Now, this is, of course, before he became a big deal, the Steve McQueen. He played a lot of little roles, including a role in that infamous campy movie of the 50s, The Blob.
Yep. And the great quote in that one was, and I got this, you won't see it in print, and I got this from the producer of The Blob, Jack Harris. And I had interviewed him for another book. And he said he bumped into McQueen. Before he bumped into McQueen, he was at the – this took place in the 70s. And the blob took place in the late 50s. And so the two hadn't seen each other for a while. And they were at the Trancas Market in Malibu. And there was a lady taking McQueen's groceries and scanning them, talking about all of his great movies. McQueen's going, yeah, that was a good one. And then Jack Harris yells out, "What about Othello?" Or, I'm sorry, he said, "What about the blob?" He looks back and he spots Harris and he smiles. He goes, "Well, it wasn't Othello now, exactly now, was it?"
Othello and, of course, the blob. I wonder what. Of course, for those who have never heard of the blob or those who aren't familiar with it, it was basically one of those sci-fi, it was kind of like Jell-O invades a town and starts eating people. Is that kind of a basic glimpse of what the blob was all about?
That's a great summation of the film. You know, back then, you didn't think about streaming video or VHS or DVDs. We thought that this movie was going to come and go. And so he thought, well, you know, I need the experience. I need the cash and I'll just do it. And then later on when he became a big star, he was very embarrassed by it. But then at the end of his life, he kind of got a kick out of the fact that he did it. And he actually called his daughter, Terry, on the phone one day and said, hey, because he was divorced to the mother at the time. He said, hey, watch this channel. The blob's on right now. And of course, back then, you know, you could only see something again if it was on TV. And so he kind of learned to live with the blob and make fun of it and make fun of himself.
Well, that's good, though. It's always good to be able to make fun of it. I mean, it certainly have a good sense of humor, and it seems that's something he did. And he certainly seemed to get along with a lot of people that he worked with to an extent. The guys, of course, the kind of group that they had there and that was going through the movies and all that. It seems like he, overall, although he had his times, for the most part, he was a very interesting guy.
Yeah, he was. He was. It always seemed like he always had something going on. You know, if he wasn't doing a great film, he always had something else going on in his life, or he had some sort of drama going on. You know, I talked to a lot of his friends, and they just said life with him was just so interesting. I remember James Coburn, the great actor, just basically saying, you know, guys like McQueen made life interesting, and he said, "No, I'm going to miss him." And so, you know, McQueen was just one of those guys that just, if something wasn't happening, he made it happen. That's the best way I can sum it up.
James Coburn, our man Flint. I don't know why every time I think of James Coburn, I think of that thing because that was his phone ringing, right? Remember? Okay.
As a matter of fact, I was going through Netflix the other night and I saw it. And what I like doing, going through and looking at the old movie trailers, and I saw Our Man Flint. I said, you know, I've never seen the actual movie trailer theater for that, so let me check it out. And it was so bad. It was so campy. And they showed him dancing, and it was cringeworthy, but it was just kind of funny.
Yeah, well, you know, especially the exaggerated dance moves. And I mean, it was basically like Batman and Robin from TV days.
Right. With a touch of misogyny in there. Man, that's a movie.
Yeah, but back then everybody got away with that stuff, which isn't right, mind you. But back then it was like, I want to say what, the 60s, 70s, early 70s?
1967 is when that movie came out.
And then In Like Flint was the sequel.
Right.
Okay. All right. See, that'll be your next book. Maybe. Well, I don't know. We'll see.
I actually had a couple of conversations with Coburn, and I begged him to do a book. And he basically said, I can't see myself doing a book. He said that would be an egotistic endeavor, is what he said. And I said, yes, maybe, but you've got these great stories that no one knows, and they're going to die with you. And I could talk to him.
That would have been a great book. That would have been a lot of fun as well. We're going to take a break here on the Talking About Cars podcast. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about what it was like to be Steve McQueen when Bullet was being made, some of the things that were on his mind then, also some of the other movies he's done, and we're going to get more. Again, we're talking to Marshall Terrell, who has written this book, And the name of the book again is?
Steve McQueen in His Own Words.
Steve McQueen in His Own Words. And we'll be back with Marshall right after this break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey, welcome back to the Talking About Cars podcast. I'm Randy Cardoon. That is Marshall Terrell from the book Steve McQueen in His Own Words. And again, it's a great book. It comes out in early November. You're going to want to get a certain look at this book because it's a picture book, but it's got all these great Steve McQueen quotes on it. And where do you find all these great pictures, Marshall?
Well, it's just a matter of research. In the beginning of his life, for example, there's a picture of the hospital where he was born in Beech Grove, Indianapolis. And I consulted a gentleman who was the spokesperson for the hospital, and we actually became really good friends. And he sent that to me and said, yeah, no problem. And then I found his birth certificate. And I consulted a librarian at the Beech Grove Library. And so I got that from him. I went to Slater, Missouri, where he grew up, and I befriended a couple of the townspeople, and they gave me photos of the town, and then the newspaper there. So it's just kind of this constant journey of looking, seeking it out, but also, through my travels, I meet people who have held on to these photos of Steve McQueen for years and allowed me use of them. And then, of course, there's photo data banks where you go and you use them. But I always try to find pictures and documents and photos that haven't been seen before. Of course, that's a very tough task because he was such a well-photographed guy. But, I try to seek out all sorts of different resources.
Yeah, it's an interesting book, and it has so many quotes. We talked about this earlier in the podcast. It's like 500 quotes, and great pictures. It's something you're certainly going to want to. It's a great coffee table book, if nothing else. And I think it tells some interesting stories of a guy who's not only well known as an actor and is known for certain kind of roles, but is also associated with motor vehicles, racing, and motorcycles. And that, for our group, certainly the folks that watch this podcast, that's something, and listen to the podcast, that's something I think that people are interested in. And it's been, sadly, 40 years since he's passed away. That's hard to believe.
It really is. And it goes by so fast. But to get back to the motorcycle pictures and photos, that was the easy part. And the easy part was finding quotes because he was... McQueen was a tough guy to interview. He did not want to talk about himself. He did not want to talk about his personal life. He talked about acting, that it was a candy-ass profession. And the way he acted, he didn't have a lot of respect for it. He actually did. But what he was easiest talking about was motorcycle racing. But he was also careful not to go too far and promote himself as a professional driver or a guy that uses motorcycling or racing to get publicity. So the only thing that wasn't tempered about his life was when he talked about his passion for motorcycles and racing. That becomes abundantly clear when you see these quotes.
Yeah, one of your great quotes was, "I'm not sure if I'm an actor who races or a racer who acts."
And he gave that quote when he was in England, and he actually he did the movie The War Lover with Robert Wagner. Excuse me, and. The reason why he took that job was that he could do a lot of professional racing. I mean, think about it. What actor today would do something like that? So he took that job on so that he could get a lot of professional racing under his belt. And it was at that time he hadn't broken just yet. The Great Escape had not come out. And he was really seriously contemplating a career as a racer. But he knew that it would be limited physically and that it wouldn't be as much money. And so that was, but his next picture was The Great Escape. And he realized, hey, I need to do movies for my wife and I can continually do it and it won't break down my body like motorcycle racing would.
Was it the Great Escape he was doing when the studios kind of got on him for basically racing cars? He had to kind of quit that for a while?
Yes, I think the story is that they got him way before that. I think on the set of Hell is for Heroes, a few movies before, he had wrecked a couple of rental cars, and they said the next one that you wreck is going to go on your bill. He stopped that. They did ask him not to race or participate in England, and he did it anyway. And then, of course, he got a couple of tickets on The Great Escape. And then I've found these incredible new photos of him on the set of The Great Escape in these black motorcycle leathers. And there's one picture where he's really airborne. I'd always heard the story of, he could have done that jump himself. And I always thought, maybe, maybe not. But then you see this picture and you go, okay, he could have done that jump easily. But yeah. He didn't because of insurance reasons.
Yeah, well, that obviously is something that they have to come across, especially in the movie business. They always have to worry what he's doing. But he's the kind of guy, at least as you get an idea by reading your book, that he kind of is going to do that no matter what, if he can get away with it. It didn't really matter what the studios wanted. He kind of would sneak away if he had to and do it under the guise of something else. So he was kind of a guy who was going to race no matter what.
Right. And there's a good photo of him with his face busted up after he went to Germany for the Olympic trials. And, he got busted up pretty good. There's a lot of stitches in his face. He really freaked out at that time. That's when the realization came to him. Hey, my face is my meal ticket. I can't be doing this as serious as I used to in the past.
So that was Olympic trials for
the 1964 team.
Motorcycle racing?
Yes.
See, we don't have that today. See, that's a sport. Maybe that's a sport we have to bring back. I guess at one point they were talking about BMX or something like that, but no. That's because they're starting to bring back old sports. Maybe we start bringing back motorcycle racing. I'm just saying.
Well, and the interesting thing about that was I found out kind of behind the scenes, like he had to fund everything. He had to pay for everybody to get over there, pay for the motorcycles. There was no such thing really as sponsorships back then. So McQueen was underwriting everything, but that showed you how much he wanted to do it and how much it meant to him. As a matter of fact, there's a great picture in the book of him holding the American flag and smoking a cigarette, talking about how deeply embedded he is as an American. And he didn't realize that until he was in another country.
So he goes on to do Bullet. And apparently with some of the racing scenes in there, and I say racing, it's not really racing. It's certainly the well-known car scene where he's bouncing around San Francisco's Lombard Street and all these other places. Well, yeah, I believe part of it was on Lombard Street. Anyway, he was bouncing around all the streets and doing all sorts of things in the car. The Mustang's diving. He's being chased by a Dodge Charger, and eventually that gets imploded when it goes into a gas station. Of course, it's all set up by special effects. But still, apparently, according to the book, his wife didn't really appreciate some of the driving mishaps on that.
Right. And he had – and I actually talked to the stunt coordinator of that film, and he said McQueen had torn up some cars, and he was kind of tired of McQueen anyway. And then, of course, the morning that this big stunt was going to be required of him, he got this phone call saying, hey, you don't have to come in until 10 a.m. or something. And when he got on the set, he discovered that Bud Eakins, who doubled him in The Great Escape, was also doubling him as a driver. And he realized that he had been had. But they basically just kind of said, look, you've got to cool it. And, you've got to let Bud do the heavy lifting on this one. But there are some interesting shots in Bullet where – If you see the rearview mirror and you see McQueen's face, he's actually driving. But when you see it flipped up, he's not driving.
Ah.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, the reason I brought that up as well is there was some remark in there about apparently his wife showed up on the set and started raising some hell, apparently, during some part of the shooting of Bullet. Because, again, he was probably racing a little too much.
Right. And she had to endure, she not only had to endure his racing in private, she also had to endure, you know, these flights of fancy when it came to doing stunts. Because McQueen was just, he was a macho guy, and he just didn't want anybody know, he certainly didn't want the public knowing that he had a stuntman. As a matter of fact, one of his stuntmen on the set of The Getaway, if you recall, McQueen wore a trench coat. And anytime this other stuntman appeared on the set with a trench coat, McQueen would quietly slink off, or he'd take off his jacket just so the public would know that he was a stuntman.
Ah, very yeah. Interesting. Okay. There was a lot of, he came into the news really about a, I want to say about 6 months to a year ago. Well, it had to be more than 6 months, but it was the end of last year because the Bullitt Mustang sold.
Right.
They came out of the blue about a few years ago. The guy who owned it and McQueen actually tried to buy it from him, correct?
That's correct. In the letter where he attempted to buy, and I say attempted, it was a pretty bad attempt because he ends the letter with something to the effect of, but if you want too much money for it, then let's just forget it. I mean, there was no sweet talk. There was no good bedside manner. That's just kind of how McQueen was. So I put that in the letter because it's kind of amusing if you read it with that point of view.
Yeah, it's real interesting. And again, he has the letter, or at least the copy of the letter, in the book. So you're going to want to check that out because there's all sorts of great stuff about that. And certainly a lot of great car pictures, which I think anybody really appreciates when you take a look at how that all worked out and some of the cars in there. In his own words, that is a coffee table book.
Yeah, and it's 5 pounds. It's heavy.
Wow, you could do curls. All right.
Yeah, I could. My reporting buddy said, hey, you could damage little children with that book if you wanted to.
Oh, what? As long as we're talking about lifting, there was something in there which, if you want to amaze your friends, this is a bit of trivia about Steve McQueen. It talks about how he had something he would do curls with at a younger age. I guess right after he just got married, too. He would have this thing that he would do curls with or work out with and use it as weights in his home. And if you want to be like a big man on campus and know what this is, Marshall, tell us what it was.
Well, it was one of those old bus stops, some mobile bus stops that he got in New York City. So, you know, he didn't have any money, so he grabbed it off the street and used it as a barbell. But he kept it all those years as a reminder of, you know, his salad days in New York City. And there's a picture of him, you know, using it in New York City, but there's also a picture, I think, in Hollywood where he had it somewhere tucked away in his house. So, you know, kind of cool that he had an old reminder of the good old days.
Yeah, it's really kind of neat. He kept that around like a little thing he work out with, and it reminded about his days when he didn't have as much money and he was just starting out, kind of a way to keep him grounded. These are great stories, Marshall. I appreciate the time you've taken to join us here on the Talking About Cars podcast. Good luck with the book, because, you know, from the looks of it, it's going to be real nice. I mean, I've seen it, and it's got all sorts of great stuff in it. By the way, don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to our audio podcast on radio.com and KNX1070.com. Also, listen to us on Alexa. You could even listen on Apple Podcasts. Stitcher has us. Just look out for Talking About Cars. Watch our video podcast on our Two Tired Guys Productions channel on YouTube. Follow us on social media. And if you wanted to support us and get your name on our credits, it's easy. All you have to do is become a Two Tired Guys patron on patreon.com. So until next time, I'm Randy Cardoon, and that's Marshall Terrell and his book, Steve McQueen, In His Own Words. And we're all talking about cars. We'll see you next time, everybody. Thanks for joining us.